A marriage is a close or intimate union between two people or two things, according to Merriam-Webster. The dictionary definition does not specify that the union be easy or even that it be happy. Krista Bremer learned this lesson the way we all do, through her own marriage. Bremer is a self-described California surfer girl. Her husband, Ismail, is a Libyan refugee, a devout Muslim trying to honor his culture in predominantly Judeo-Christian North Carolina, where they live. They encountered more than the usual hurdles that face most married people. Bremer explores her relationship in her new memoir. It's called My Accidental Jihad, A Love Story. I asked her how she and her husband first met.
I had moved to North Carolina to do a fellowship at graduate school at UNC, and I'm a runner, so I would run on the wooded trails around the university, and I began to notice him there. We were sort of, you know, running the same circles, and after a while, we became friendly with one another, and we became running partners, as I describe in the book, before we ever dated.
You didn't actually plan to get married when it happened.
No, it really, everything about this relationship caught me by surprise. You know, I really remember those early days of knowing him as a time of great inner turmoil, because on one hand, you know, I felt more at home with him than I had with anyone else in my life. And on the other hand, he was almost exactly the opposite of what I had imagined for myself. So I was experiencing a lot of inner conflict at that time.
Well, you write of yourself before you went to North Carolina as kind of the quintessential California surfer girl. You were living near the beach, and I'm looking at you now. You have blonde hair. You're tan. And this man, not what you envisioned for yourself, and he's not a surfer boy.
No, not just that either. You know, there were so many things about him that struck me as foreign. And, you know, and it wasn't actually just his faith or his culture. It was also, you know, he was older than me. And it was really also the way he was living. You know, when I met him, he was living in a very small apartment that, you know, the first time I stepped into it, the first word that came to mind for me was poor, you know, because he was living so simply. And yet, as I spent time in that apartment, I realized that it contained all the basics. It was just that it contained so little else. You know, so even the way he lived was provocative to me, because I always imagined, you know, adulthood as this sort of game of acquisition. And, you know, that the person that I was with would be someone who was successful or upwardly mobile. You know, I had certain assumptions about that.
How much did you know about Libya or Islam when you met this man?
Oh, I knew almost nothing about Libya. In fact, I didn't at first know he was Libyan, and I recall when he told me that he was Libyan, I was sort of shocked and a little bit disappointed, because, you know, there are cultures that have a certain romantic mystique about them. You know, even if he had said, you know, Moroccan, I might have had a different feeling. But all I recalled about Libya was the fact that when I was in high school, there was an announcement on the news one day that we had bombed this country. And it was a fact, you know, that was taken as so, you know, that action was so necessary and that there was no chance of retaliation, that it almost didn't even warrant a conversation. It was just sort of passing news, you know. And then, of course, you know, there were the Libyans in Back to the Future who were screaming around the parking lot, spraying gunfire all over the mall.
I think maybe listeners who are paying attention to our conversation now say Libya, and then you say Gaddafi.
Yes.
You know, not anymore, but because something happened in the interim. But I think that sort of overly zealous leader, fanatic, some might describe him as crazy, other people have described him as, was emblematic of a whole country.
Oh, that's absolutely right. I mean, I would say psychotic. You know, he was a terrifying and brutal leader. And I think, you know, I came to understand that the Libyans suffered a double tragedy because they were horribly oppressed under Gaddafi. And then the entire world conflated the Libyan people with Gaddafi. So not only were they brutalized by him, but they had to also endure that type of stereotyping.
I'm speaking with Krista Bremer. Her memoir is called My Accidental Jihad, A Love Story. And while we're on the subject of misunderstood things, jihad, the word itself, I think a lot of us in the United States think of jihad as a sort of zealous mission. What actually does this word mean, and why did you choose it for the title of your book?
Well, I knew when I chose this word that it was a risky word because many people associate it with horrific acts of violence. And I also knew from my husband that the Prophet Muhammad taught that the greatest jihad or struggle of our lives is the one that takes place in our hearts to overcome our lower impulses, to do battle with our egos so that we can become more wise and humble and tolerant and generous for the sake of humanity. And for me, that there's no better description of marriage, because that's really how I experience marriage and family. It's the place where I'm constantly confronted with my selfishness, my intolerance, and it's where I'm striving every day to, you know, make my heart open a little bit more.
A pretty good example of that is an extended visit that you, your husband, and your daughter paid to Libya. I'm not sure how long you were there, but it seemed like a long time in the book, several weeks, right?
Yes, that's right. We were there 3 weeks.
And you, your husband came, from a humble place, I guess. I don't know how else to describe it because I've never visited Libya,
yes.
But it didn't sound like he was from a grand, rich background, as you describe it, and from a family that was very traditional, that really, it seemed, pushed you in this jihad that you were taking internally.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it was so interesting for me. When I think about my time in Libya, I think about the relentless intimacy of that place, because I had traveled quite a bit, but in my travels, I was accustomed to retreating to hostels or hotels, you know, to take a break from a foreign culture and commiserate with other foreigners. And here I found myself in these crowded homes of relatives who were almost constantly in physical contact with me. And I found that to be both maddening and transformative, because it became this crucible for growth. You know, it really made me rethink my individualism, my sense of individualism, and how it both serves me and undermines me.
So you're on this physical journey to Libya, which is part of your internal journey in your marriage and your family. Obviously, Libya's not the end of this book. That isn't the end of your struggle. What was also fascinating is that you and your husband have these two kids. The eldest is a girl who was on her own journey that actually, it seemed, forced you to come to terms yet again with conflict. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. When my daughter was about 9 years old, there was a period of time when she decided to experiment with wearing the headscarf. And it was an interesting time for me because I'd always encouraged my daughter to express her individuality and resist peer pressure. And yet she chose the very form of expression that was the most difficult for me to handle, you know, in that way that children brilliantly do to their parents. And, you know, so I began to examine my own reactions to this particular piece of cloth. Why was I reacting so strongly? And I began to rethink all of the exposure that I had experienced growing up in Southern California. And ultimately, I came to the conclusion that if some women find freedom in exposing themselves, it's equally valid for others to find freedom in covering themselves. And I wrote an essay about these reflections that appeared in O Magazine. And it was very interesting to receive mail from all over the world. You know, I realized I had touched on a hot, hot topic. And, you know, on one hand, I was hearing from Muslims all over the world who were, you know, saying, thank God, you know, your daughter has found God and she's on the right path. And then on the other hand, I was hearing from women who really felt like they could have been my friends, who identified themselves as feminists, and many of them were academics, and they judged me very harshly. You know, they called me a shameful parent for subjecting my daughter to a tool of misogyny. And it was interesting for me because to me, that essay was not even about the headscarf. It was about parenting and what we do when, you know, we come up against aspects of our children that we don't understand.
It also, to me, is sort of a facet because this book, it's about a marriage. It's about two cultures learning to live together, two people from different cultures learning to blend, raising kids. But this is also a story of your own quest for some sort of spiritual core. And I'm wondering, because you kind of hint at it, but you never say it, is that Islam for you?
Well, I was a seeker long before I met my husband. And, you know, and I think that's a quintessentially American quality that I have. You know, I've always taken great inspiration from reading about the prophets. And I, you know, I would include Buddha in that. I would include Martin Luther King and Jesus Christ. And now I would certainly include Muhammad, whose teachings absolutely inspire me.
So there's no ism, is that what you're saying here?
No, I'm on the same quest that I was before I met my husband, which is to learn and to grow and to become a better person, I would say. And, you know, and for me, on one level, this book is about a secular middle-class American and a North African Muslim. But I really believe that every marriage is bicultural, simply because it contains two people. And once you have two people, you have two radically different assumptions and ideas about love and family and what those look like. And you have to navigate those differences. And I believe you ultimately arrive at a place where your mate feels impossibly foreign to you. And that's the place that interests me. You know, what we do in those moments interests me a great deal. And that's what I try to explore in this book.
I'm curious. I want part two, your husband's jihad. this is really about your inner thoughts, but I'm sure he read it and he participated in it. So over the course of your marriage and parenting experiences and all the things that you've gone through together, do you think that he's taken the same journey or a similar kind of journey?
Well, absolutely. I mean, he's my very first reader of everything that I put down. And so he's very much been on this journey of writing this book with me. And he's, you know, it's fascinating and inspiring to me. He has a wholehearted belief in free expression, even more so than just about any other American I know. And I'm sure this comes from growing up under such horrible oppression and being denied the right to speak basic truths for most of his life. So he wholeheartedly believes in telling the truth the best we can. And he believes good comes from that. So, you know, he's always told me, your job is to express the truth the very best you can and allow me to grapple with the consequences of that. You know, so I think he's been extremely courageous and supportive with this.
Krista Bremer, thank you so much for coming in today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.